I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Those of you who've been following this podcast over the last couple of years or know me personally understand that I'm quite passionate about how important it is to establish a strong culture within a company. I define culture as how we get things done, fueled by vision, behaviors, and process. Culture is not something that's separate from the bottom line or the P&L. It's actually the enabler of that. And over the years, I've talked to many people about how they create strong cultures. Could be team building events, a strong strategic plan, a reinforcement of company values, et cetera, et cetera. But what do you do if you are a startup, literally starting your company out of your garage? How do you build a culture from the very beginning to make sure that it lasts and, more importantly, that it can scale as you grow over time? But my next guest on the Business of Intuition has done just that. He has, in fact, even started his business right from his garage and grown it into something that is now nationwide with over 150 people. Mark Reifenrath is the CEO and co-founder of Spinutech. Spinutech has grown from a university dorm startup over 20 years ago to a multinational digital agency with 150-plus team members across the United States. In that capacity, he understands firsthand how critical a company culture is to achieving and maintaining success. You might ask, what's the secret to his particular success? Well, company values that are truly lived, including a commitment to, quote-unquote, get better every day. The company would not be what it is today without a team of people who are as invested in each other's growth and success as they are in delivering the best for their clients. Mark Reifenrath on the Business of Intuition. So Mark, thanks for being a guest on the Business of Intuition. I just wanted to start us off with a question to get us going here. I'm thinking about Hewlett-Packard in a way that they started their business, I believe, if it's not just lore, out of a garage many, many moons ago. And of course, we all knew how well they've done since then. And as I understand it, there's something similar in your world where you kind of got an idea, graduated from college, and started building this digital marketing company out of your house, or your garage. One, is that true? And then two, how did you do that? Because most people think about, you know, starting a new idea as one in which will scale. You know, it's not going to be like, I'm always going to be doing everything for 20 years. I have a vision of it getting bigger and bigger, but very few people make their businesses last, let alone scale it. So maybe walk us through how you did it.
Yeah. So 2000 was the year, the middle of the dot-com bubble. I was a junior at the University of Northern Iowa. And really, the jobs were not there for people that were coming up on graduation. So the idea was really simple. It's, hey, I kind of know how to build websites. A couple of my buddies kind of knew how to build websites. Let's do this as a resume builder. And so we jokingly today say that we started in the executive suites of Jack's Manor, which was, it's still there, but it was a typical college apartment complex, and executive suites is far from accurate in describing it. But since that was our business address, that's what we referred to it as. So we really intended to build some websites, relatively simple, for some local businesses to create a resume that would then be more attractive than our competition, which were the students around us. Now, that quickly turned into, we won the local hospital website, which was way out of our league. It was a, you know, relatively big deal. We helped a Target distribution center come to Cedar Falls, Iowa. That was a big deal. We helped the local economic development group build a website to help promote that and win them to go there. Then we won a large grocery chain in the Midwest. We won Bridgestone Firestone. So it just kind of, what started as more of a resume builder turned into, holy crap, this is actually going to be a business. Now, we struggled. We had no outside investment. We just bootstrapped it. One of my business partners lived in the basement of our first, he's going to hate that I said that, in the basement of our first office that we paid like $100 for. I think he paid $100 cash on the side cubicle walls for his apartment in the basement. So when I hear of people saying bootstrapping, I'm like, you don't really know what that looks like from what I know we did. We didn't pay ourselves for the first couple of years. We really put out every dollar back into the business to try to either get a few team members to help us do stuff better or market ourselves. So it evolved from that resume builder to let's actually create something here. And then it did take off when we kind of had that mind shift. And you fast forward to today, we've got 5 locations, 175 team members, clients in all 50 states, 20 plus countries, a lot of names you would know. So I think there's evolutions for us anyways of how we started and maybe reinventing where we wanted to go, because what we were dreaming of as big in 2000 was very small. And once you expand your world outside of the town you live in there for clients, and then to maybe the state and then the Midwest, and then beyond that, you have to rethink, for us anyways, what our goals were and what we wanted to accomplish.
So let's go back to what you said before about this resume builder strategy right out of college. You know, it sounds like in some ways it sort of surprised you that the success happened as quickly as it did. Am I wrong in that?
No. I mean, we didn't have any expectations. It was, let's do a few projects and have a story to tell in an interview. That was really some of the initial conversations.
So then how does a company that is so, I guess, just starting off, land some of these large clients? Because obviously, in some ways, Mark, I can kind of relate. I mean, be quite honest with you. Our company started 30 years ago. We were just two people doing coaching, you know, for small business owners. And then we were able to land a training program that got us some press. And we had Alaska Airlines and AT&T and Weyerhaeuser. All of a sudden, the big boys and girls were now calling us. And that was the turning point that I believe has made a big difference in our surviving so many years. I mean, literally 3 decades was a big piece of our maturation. And it sounds in some ways, you had some big wins early on. How did you get those big wins?
So there's so many different little wrinkles to every one of these stories. And I'm sure there was for yours too. And
sure.
One of the things we did was we joined the local chamber, which before I accidentally walked into their offices, I didn't know what the chamber was. We walked in, they had a wall of pamphlets of a bunch of businesses, and that to us was a lead opportunity. Well, we didn't know about them. And somebody came out and said, hey, what are you guys doing? Happened to know that individual, and she was very kind. And we're like, what do you guys do? And she kind of described it. And so we ended up joining, and we went to a new luncheon. And there were so many people that we got connected in the local business community at that point that were kind of supporting us and fans of ours. Even if they weren't clients, they were connecting us to different people. Oh, you need a lawyer? You need to talk to this person. You need a CPA? You need to talk to this person. And so we kind of built this fan base of, you know, rooting for the underdog, so to speak. And so we did a really good job of networking. And then I would say kind of exploiting our age in a positive way. We were in college still, and people my age probably now then were attracted to reliving some of their, you know, former glory days maybe through us. And so, you know, the networking events, you know, we were primed to do those really well. Typically some appetizers and some drinks. We were perfect at that time. So, yeah. You know, and we stood out in that crowd. We were by far the youngest. People were, who in the heck are these new people? What are they doing here? What's their story? And we did a good job of taking advantage of that and telling it, and I would suppose being a little bold and saying, we'd love to work with you. To your point though, about there was a tipping point. I know for us, we had some success, and then we were kind of hitting this wall or ceiling, and we were just getting some no's, and we were kind of getting bigger opportunities. And you're saying, why are we not winning? What is it? And I can distinctively remember a point where the only thing that changed was our confidence. And we were saying the same things, but it was being heard differently because we were saying it, the same words, we were just saying it differently. And that confidence, I mean, that's what people buy a lot of times. They want to know that what you're saying is actually going to happen as good as you're saying it or better. And once they bought that confidence from us, man, boom, we took off and started winning a bunch more, had to hire a few people, had to start thinking about some more complex things than the way the simple business was when it was just the three of us. But that confidence change was a significant moment in our growth trajectory for sure.
So that's a huge point you just made. I had to write it down on my little tablet here because I think that is a theme that not only is good for entrepreneurs, startups to keep in mind, but also people who work for large organizations. You want to get promoted. You have an idea. You want to be able to expand your career in a company. That confidence piece is obviously a big part of that. So what was it that you, I want to get into culture and values and all that other stuff, but I have to follow this thread. Just one more step here with you, if you don't mind. How did you go from, hey, imposter syndrome, we're kids, to we're now confident? What was the process to get you from, are we good enough to, damn right, we're good enough?
So I'm super competitive, at times to a fault probably. And I think when you're not used to losing, and in my head, we were losing more than we should have been, I kind of got pissed off. I was like, no, we deserve this work. Like, we should have this work. And so there was almost an anger that had to boil over for me to then maybe fight a little harder and not allow for somebody to say no. I may have been doing some other subtle things of just, if I saw an objection, just hitting it head on and directly and saying, why is that a problem? We can fix that. Let's do this. And working through that with the prospect to really give them that confidence that no, I am this confident that we're going to deliver. And so that would be one. The other point I would make is, I think for me in our journey, 22 years deep now, I've had to reinvent or reframe that confidence as we've scaled. Because with confidence, you have confidence in a specific area or I'm a golfer, obviously. When you play the same course over and over, you build a confidence because you understand the conditions and the course and the holes and where you should and shouldn't go. When you're pitching the same types of businesses, the size and what you're doing, you build confidence in that. As you move up the food chain, though, that can be altered. And now you maybe walk into a room that you're not as comfortable in. So as we've kind of gone up that food chain with the types of clients we work in, I've had to kind of rebirth some of that confidence at times to make sure I'm portraying accurately who we are and what we can do to make them feel that.
Good point. Excellent. All right. So I love what you're saying here about the confidence piece. Let's transition a little bit in terms of where I thought we would start, which is around culture and values and so forth. Got a lot of questions on this, but let me just start off. What's your hiring process like? What do you look for to be able to attract the kind of people that are going to fit your culture? What's that process go? What do you go through?
Yeah, so our hiring process has gotten hard and long for an applicant intentionally because we want to make sure we're weeding out the people that aren't cut out for who we are. So first step, you know, we've got a group of team members that recruit. So depending on what piece of the business, they're out there looking for that talent. Building that relationship. Once we get to the point where we want to actually engage in an interview, step one is really just a culture screen. It's just ensuring that they align with our core values and our culture. We don't directly ask those questions, obviously, but we're trying to make sure that you don't have an ego. There's not arrogance. You're not a ladder climber. You're a team player. We just want that alignment. And if there's any sniff of one of those things being off, they're probably not going to make it even to the next round unless they think, did I hear that right? Do I want somebody else to gut check it? So that's step one. If they pass that, we're going to go into a group interview with the team they would work on, progressing all the way to a final interview with me, which is questions and really that final gut check on core values and culture.
Okay. So that first step, though, I want to ask you about that a little bit. I'm assuming, not knowing your company well, but you've already indicated that you already have core values. And so it's really pretty clear about what that means. How do you determine if a person is aligned to those core values or not? Because in interviews, people are going to perform the way in which they will be accepted, right? So if I know, like, hey, we have no ego in this company, and the applicant says, well, I don't either, you know, because I want the job, right? So how do you get to the truth versus just be given the performance?
Yeah. So here's an example of a question that somebody might ask to unveil that. Tell me about a project that you worked on that was really successful. And so it's pretty broad in general, but if they're going to answer it and saying, I did this project and it achieved this success that I was responsible for. And really, they're only including themselves. Because in business, how many projects do you work on by yourself? Very, very few. And so are they going to give any credit to the team around them? Are they going to be humble enough to not take all the credit? And that's tough in an interview because you're trying to make yourself shine. And we will maybe dig at that. You know, there's a good interview trick. You ask the same question three times in three different ways. If you're in to really kind of get the true answer on the third time. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of keep digging in that and maybe even try to walk them into it if they'll fall for that trap of giving themselves all the credit. And if they're not, you're going to say, well, did anybody else work on that project? What was their roles and responsibilities for that? And what impact did they have on the success? So it's maybe the bailout of, oh, you know, yes, this was my role, but man, I wouldn't have been able to do that without them. So that's just an example of trying to get them to go down that path and seeing how they're going to react. And it, most people, if they have that ego, they're going to bite on that pretty quick inadvertently and expose it relatively in short order.
I'm curious about why you used that example in some ways. Let me just ask you this, because it's, you mentioned the fact that early on in this conversation that you're very competitive, almost to a fault. Is there a part of being very competitive that is about ego?
Well, sure. We all have an ego. It just matters where it exposes itself, and is it in a positive way? They're, like, ego is always looked at as bad.
Right.
There's positive parts of it too. So can you have an ego that is catering to others and humble and inclusive of others and not just self-serving? And so we want to make sure that we're exposing the positive parts of that as opposed to the negative ones. So yeah, absolutely. I want somebody who is competitive and likes to win, 100%. And I use a ton of sports analogies, but you know, the analogy from a sports perspective is you don't want a team of LeBrons. Sorry if you're a LeBron fan. You want a team that is truly a team. And so the NBA finals in recent history have been amazing because the Golden State Warriors have had a team that plays really well together. When the Raptors, an Iowa-based head coach, shout out, won theirs, very well at playing as a team together. They absolutely had stars. But you don't win a championship with just a couple stars. You need the supporting roles to all be cohesive as one unit.
All right. So what do you mean by team? And I mean that there's sometimes we would define team as a series of behaviors. And sometimes we define team as also a structure whereby we have mutual accountability to produce a result that we couldn't individually produce. What do you mean by team?
Yeah. So one distinctive thing that we do is we don't call people employees. We call them team members because they're part of a team.
Okay.
What you're getting at is team members come to do great work with others. So that's the way that we would look at that. So it's a broader sense of that, of just being a team member and doing great work with others. Okay. Employees come to check boxes and check clocks. So we're just saying, if you're going to tout that title of team member for us, you have a different approach and attitude towards work. You're passionate about it. You do want to do great work. You're not going to take the credit just yourself. You realize you need a team of great people around you to accomplish great things.
Okay. Going back to the hiring process again, I have noticed in some industries that because of the great resignation that we have now coined this particular time that we're in, where somewhere around 50% of all employees are currently looking for other jobs, 78% of people, you know, are feeling some version of burnout. 25% feel that their biggest issue is their supervisor. So there's a lot of movement going on. There's a lot of options going on for employees or team members to be able to look for other greener pastures if they don't like where they are. So in that kind of where the power in a way has been shifted really into the hands of the employee per se, are you finding that you're having to employ people that you wouldn't have before because we just don't have enough skilled people?
So this is a what you just described is a trap that a lot of companies fall into. So we've always had this rule, hire the best person for the job. But pre-COVID, that was as long as they were in one of the markets, we had an office. Now it's best person for the job, no matter where they're at in the US.
Yeah.
We have to maintain that standard though, to not just put a butt in a seat, because when you do that, you're compromising. There's a reason if you hire fast just to fill the role, something's going to be off. There's going to be some misalignment with one of your core values or multiple ones. You've allowed a cancer to enter your front door and potentially spread to the team they're on or the broad team very quickly. And that's going to be more work than it is in pain than it is to be patient for the right person to fill that role. So it's getting buy-in from the team that maybe there's going to be a little bit of pain for all of us in lifting that extra weight for the next 30, 60 days until we find the right person, versus bringing in that person that's not going to do great work, not going to be a team player, and cause even more pain.
I agree with you 100% on that. Totally. And I would suspect and wonder what you think, that that slower approach, that more methodic, careful approach might require the scaling of a company to take a slower pace. You could fill up your office or virtual office with a bunch of people, a bunch of bodies, and maybe in the short term get some business, but maybe it's not going to be sustainable.
So you've got to attract the right clients. So the same filter goes for the clients. We want the right fit for clients that are going to be great partners, and same for the team. And, you know, I think with sales, a lot of times people fall into the trap of, we need to have the people before we sell, or, you know, what if we sell too much? You know what? If you got a yes and you had to tell them no, that's a really good problem. But most businesses don't push that limit of saying no to sold business. They try to, you know, just put butts in seat and get impatient. So we're okay, even I would say overselling. Now we've been able to balance it properly, but we have the mentality that we would be okay turning away good work if we didn't have a great team to support it.
So then how do you identify or target or find the right client? Much like to the point you made before, you spent a lot of time finding the right team member. What's that process look like for the client?
So we have personas built for our clients, just like a lot of our clients have personas for their ideal clients. We do that work for them. We did it for ourselves. And we've identified, there's several kind of categories of the types of clients we would want to attract. And we've identified what that individual looks like, what role they're in, what kind of education they've probably had, maybe previous experiences. Revenue of the company is a small indicator that varies. And so maybe what level of experience they have in digital marketing. We don't want somebody who is a 9 or a 10 on a digital marketing scale. That's not going to, they're going to try to challenge everything we do, and it's going to make the partnership a little bit harder. We want somebody that's between a 3 and a 7 or maybe an 8 in knowledge. They're going to need the partner and really lean on us, as opposed to just challenging everything we do. We do want challenge, but not in a negative way. And so we've got, there's a pretty big filter that we're going to put them through. And then it's just a culture fit as well. They may fit all those boxes, but if they don't they look at us as a vendor only and not a partner, that's a problem for us. We really want to build a true partnership. And we're not interested in a short-term engagement. We want somebody that's going to be a client for a long time with us so that we can really dig in, and they can invest in us, we can invest in them, and produce great results.
Do you have we talk about the persona of the ideal client. Do you actually kind of break it down into steps or break it down into subcomponents? You mentioned some of them already, but I could almost wonder, like, there's almost like a menu. They need to address that. We need to have these things in order for us to say yes. If a certain percentage of the things that we want are not met, we might decide to pass. Is that how you perceive that?
Exactly. So we actually have some charts that have scenarios of that with, you know, green check marks and red X's. And we have some statements in there about, now, if not all of these are met, what are the exceptions? Right. And some things are no-goes. Like if that one isn't checked, it's just a non-starter. But if there's 10, let's say, we would maybe say they could have 3 of those that aren't checked, as long as they're not these 3. There's some options in there that would not, we can't find perfect clients. you know, we wouldn't be in business if we had them fit every single thing that we wanted.
Right. That's why they need you.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So on the Zoom virtual world, you said at one point it was more bricks and mortar, now that it's not required that a person lives near a particular demographic or geography. It could be anywhere. So then with your emphasis, Mark, on culture, how do you maintain it when maybe a lot of your interactions is like what we have right now?
Yeah.
With 2x2 little squares of people showing up on a computer screen.
So I think we're all learning that. We're all resetting our relationship expectations because of this. I think that when we get people together in person, they all say the same things like, man, that was really great. I really enjoyed that. So, you know, when we think of office space today and remote workers, how do we create that loyalty? How do we make sure that they're engaged? How do we check in on them? Dean, how are you doing? Fine. No, Dean, that's not what I asked. How are you doing? And really from a personal level, how is that individual doing? And so I think it does, from a leadership perspective, require a little more effort than it did when we were in the office. We just had these casual collisions in the office. We don't have those today. So we have to force those collisions to happen and say, hey, Dean, can we just eat lunch together tomorrow virtually? That seems weird. It is kind of weird, but let's do it so that we can talk and catch up and do what we used to do when we were in the office. Or you're in Florida and I'm in Iowa. How in the heck are we going to make sure we stay in touch and talk about our kids or what I did this weekend? We've got to force those interactions. We don't have the in a meeting, out of a meeting, before and after, where you're having those conversations. So it just takes a little more effort on everybody's part. When a new team member joins, I do about an hour culture and core value onboarding. And one of the things I'm telling them right now is, hey, as a company, we have an amazing process of the first 100 days and getting you onboarded to our team. However, in these times, you have to lean in as much as we are to make this truly work. So you need to reach out and say, hey, I haven't worked with you, Dean, on a project yet, but I'd love to get to know you, and spend 15, 20 minutes with them. The better we know each other as a team, when we go to battle, when we go to war, when we're getting challenged by a client, I know how you're going to react. I know when to pick you up and help you on those little cues that we're only seeing from here up. I'm 6'5", so I always tell people, hey, when we meet in person, heads up, I'm really tall. Just those little things that we got to humanize ourselves more than just the screen more and more. It's a challenge. Yeah. All of us are trying to figure it out. My goal for our leadership team is, let's set the freaking bar. I don't want to just do it okay. Let's set that bar so that people are chasing us of how we're doing.
I've heard somebody say that they were trying to create those sort of accidental connections by just simply saying, I have this particular time and these particular days where my Zoom is going to just be open, right? Yeah. So you can plop in anytime you want. I'll stop whatever I'm doing to talk with anybody who shows up. And I don't know how successful it's been, but I'm curious to see, you know, at some point if that becomes a practice that some companies might adopt.
We've done that. Our director of talent, our HR person, director of talent is what we say. I'm big on words if you haven't picked up on that. But yes, the director of talent, she does that occasionally. I don't know that it's been widely used, but I think there's also a mental acknowledgement from the team of just knowing that that's available. I think that's a healthy thing too.
Yeah. So you said something about the first 100 days as a process that is quite robust and successful. Say a little bit about that.
Yes. And technically that probably starts before their first 100 days of actual employment. It's really that first engagement as a potential team member. But once they start, yes, it's everything from how is their equipment getting packaged and sent to them? What swag are they getting? We like to personalize it. You know, Dean, what's a $20 or less self-indulgent that you have? I love Snicker bars like crazy. Okay, cool. We're going to include a couple of those in that, right? So it's personalized to you. And you have all that stuff before day one. You're ready to rock and hit it hard that first day. I want every team member to have the best first day of employment they've ever had. Somebody's going to ask them at the end of the day. It could be a parent, a spouse, a friend, whoever. Hey, Dean, how was your first day? Oh my gosh, Mark, you would not believe the first day I had. So we want that impact on day one. I'm hopefully connecting with them on day one, doing that cultural and core values overview. I personally do a handwritten note. I did a couple this morning at day 30, just saying, welcome to the team. I hope your onboarding process has been going well. I try to personalize those with things I've maybe heard about them already, the impact they're making, you know, and then my thing is hashtag get better every day. That's one of our core values, and sign off with that. We've got different leadership check-ins across that first 100 days. They're getting interactions with all the different departments and teams of what they do so they can learn that. So there's a lot in there, but the team that runs that does such a great job. And I know from our pulse surveys, those team members that are less than a year in, they love the company. They're loving how things are going. And that's a really good compliment to that onboarding process. If we have a really good first 100 days, the likelihood of retention and retainment of that great talent that we worked really hard to get is going to go up, no doubt.
Have you measured that?
Yes. So, you know, what's wonky with that, pre-COVID, we were sub 5% turnover. COVID and the Great Resignation has pushed and challenged that. So last year we were 14%, which honestly, still really good for our industry. Normal times is 20 to 30%. Hmm. For me, 14% is painful. It's almost three times what our normal is, right? So that's a hard thing to accept and swallow that pill, but we're doing better than most. I hate to say that because it's just not acceptable to me, but you know, we are doing better than most with that whole bug that's biting everybody.
And when it comes to the other side of the ledger, with the clients that you're dealing with or the ones that you are developing relationships with, address or say something about how you engage with them in a virtual environment, whereas before, maybe pre-COVID, it was face-to-face over a cup of coffee at your local Starbucks.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we've all kind of very quickly adapted and accepted the sales process being virtual. Mm-hmm. Now, I would love to, if you were going to spend a bunch of money with us, I will make every effort to come and shake your hand, break bread with you, and build that relationship at a deeper level. We sold one of our largest deals ever in 4 business days in the thick of COVID.
Wow.
So that very quickly told me the game has changed, because I was like, man, we can't go see them. How do we replicate some of the things we would normally do? And they were just down to business, and really, it was a warm lead that was, it was a referral, but even still, for the money they were spending, I was shocked how quickly they made the decision and how quickly they trusted us, which was great. I mean, we weren't selling something we weren't going to deliver. That informed me the game would change. And even existing clients, the in-person meetings have gone way down, that, you know, traveling across the country to get together. I think we've just all kind of done a reset. What I want to be cautious of is, let's not get too complacent with that and making sure we are getting together physically on some cadence to keep that this relationship virtually as strong as it can be.
Yeah, I think you're right. I've been hearing that a lot too. It's like, we can't necessarily abandon all face-to-face conversations. It still serves a very, very important purpose, but we might be more strategic about when we actually have those conversations.
Yes. Well said.
Absolutely. Yes. Excellent. Well, Mark, this has been really great. Good tips and ideas on this. What can people, I mean, if somebody wanted to follow you, understand more about what you're doing, connect with you, how would they do that?
Yeah. So I'm very active on LinkedIn, and I talk about a lot of these things either in written or text or other podcasts. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Mark with a C, and then Reifenrath is tough, Reifenrath, and I'll connect with you for sure. And would love to start a conversation about any of this. And then our website, spinningtech.com, also has a lot of this information, and you can follow along what we do. We like to have a lot of fun at work too. So there's some fun stuff on our social channels there as well.
Good. Well, thanks, Mark, for joining. It's been great to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.